Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, we're looking at a video where Wes Huff of Apologetics Canada is being interviewed about whether or not the Bible has been corrupted over time, which is really one of those questions that I don't understand why it's still being asked so frequently. I mean, I guess I know why. People who believe that the Bible is the inerrant word of God need to deal with the fact that the Bible has been corrupted without admitting that, for as long as we've had enough documentation to figure it out, we've had a record of the Bible being corrupted. So we'll get to watch as they downplay the indisputable record that we have of scribes making mistakes, adding in new things, and taking out old things in an attempt to salvage infallibility, in spite of the overwhelming evidence of fallibility. Anyway, there's only a couple weeks left on the sale at my merch store, so go to merch.vicerhino.com and use code RHINO15 at checkout for 15% off your order. On to the video!
One of the big objections, I think, in this area is that some people might say, how do we know that the Bible just hasn't been corrupted? So you're talking copies, there are Christian scribes over many, many, many generations. How do we know that the text of the Bible isn't just Chinese whispers over time where it's slowly being changed to suit political and theological agendas?
First, to address what is likely the elephant in the room for a good chunk of my North American viewers, in the UK, a lot of people call the telephone game Chinese whispers. I don't know why, and apparently neither do they, aside from some speculation about the inaccuracy of verbal messages passed on over the Great Wall of China, but given that it seems to have originated during the Cold War, a time when the UK had a bit of an issue with espionage from the USSR and China, it seems more likely that it originated out of general xenophobia. But that doesn't really matter, I just thought it would be weird to let it go completely unaddressed. Back on topic, how do we know that the Bible was not subject to the telephone game? Well, in short, we actually know the exact opposite. It most definitely was changed as it was passed on from scribe to scribe, from congregation to congregation, from country to country. And we know this because for an ancient book, we actually do have a pretty good manuscript tradition. So we can be fairly confident that the Bible we have today has been reasonably faithfully pieced together to match what the originals likely said, but it is completely undeniable that it has changed. It's just a question of what changes were made and how many of them were there.
In the mess of manuscripts that you're describing, what's your sense as to how you'd respond to that? Is this a big problem for Christianity? No, it's not.
It depends which brand of Christianity we're talking about. Wes happens to believe in biblical inerrancy, so while I have no doubt that he has some convoluted way that he accounts for the known errors in his inerrant book, the fact of the matter is that the errors of the Bible are well documented, and so are a problem for inerrancy, pretty much by definition.
There, that's the end of the discussion, right?
No, that is not the end of the discussion. I know he's being tongue-in-cheek here, but really, if the Bible were actually inerrant, that should be the end of the discussion. The fact that you have to explain away the errors that are impossible to ignore demonstrates that the Bible is not inerrant. Among apologists that I've encountered who believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, but still acknowledge that there are errors in the manuscripts, the typical way to reconcile this is to appeal to the originals. The originals are inerrant, but then fallible humans got their hands on them and copied them down, sometimes making mistakes, sometimes outright inventing passages to suit their theological agendas, sometimes deleting passages to suit their theological agendas. But none of that matters, it's the originals that are inerrant. You know, those documents that we don't have access to and so can't examine to confirm that they are inerrant? How convenient. But this doesn't even come close to solving the problem. For starters, why are the bits that we know were later insertions still included in modern Bibles if it was the originals that were inerrant and not the later copies? Did God re-inspire a later scribe, deciding that his perfect word needed an update in that particular moment? If so, why was it good enough for the first generation of Christians, but not the later Christians? And when was the cutoff point? When did God stop inspiring updates? And another thing that you keep hearing about biblical inerrancy is that it's not only that it's inerrant, it's that it is unchanging. Except we know that it did change, several times. When did those changes stop? Well, an example I've used in the past is the NIV translation inserting words into the text that fix some of the apparent errors, with those changes being removed in the 2011 version. So we know that as recently as 2011, God's unchanging word was changing. But why were those changes wrong? Could the NIV translators not have been inspired by God to fix Jesus' mustard seed gaffe? And holy hell, I should have come across this earlier, but there's a whole ass movement of Christians who oppose the 2011 NIV because, basically, it's too woke. It made thousands of changes to the 1984 version in order to use gender-neutral language, like referring to Levitical priests in the Old Testament when the more accurate translation would be the priests of the sons of Levi. So the 2011 NIV changed some verses to be more accurate to the manuscripts, like removing your from Matthew 13:32, but then turned around and changed thousands of others to be less accurate to the manuscripts. And as far as I can tell, the people who are arguing against the 2011 NIV are still fine using the 1984 version with its apologetically motivated inaccuracies. So were the translators who added your into Matthew 13:32 inspired by God to do so? Then why did God not inspire the translators of other versions to do the same with theirs? And how about Jeremiah 7:22? The NIV added the word just into that one, which completely changed its meaning. In the ESV, it is, "For in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt, I did not speak to your fathers or command them concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices." But in the NIV, both the 1984 and the 2011 editions, it is, "For when I brought your ancestors out of Egypt and spoke to them, I did not just give them commands about burnt offerings and sacrifices." That one word, just, is only found in the NIV and its offshoots, no other translations. And it makes the verse mean pretty much the exact opposite of what it means without it. Was that addition inspired by God? Was it not? How can we tell which ones are and which ones aren't? And if modern translations are not inspired by God, then again, I'm left wondering where the cutoff point was where a text could be changed and that change could have been inspired by God. Yeah, you know what? Biblical inerrancy becomes a ridiculous proposition if you actually take it seriously.
You referred to Chinese whispers, or as what's sometimes called the telephone game.
Yeah.
That is a single line transmission. It's single in the sense that it's me whispering into your ear, and then you whispering to someone else's ear. That's not true with the copying process of the New Testament. It's not a single line of transmission. It's multiple lines of transmission, and it's done by different authors writing in different locations to different audiences who are likewise in different geographical locations. And then copyists and scribes, they copy that text, and they're in different locations writing to different audiences or themselves in different locations.
Yes and no. So, yes, the authors of the New Testament did come from different regions and were writing letters to people who lived in different regions, but that doesn't actually give us multiple lines of transmission of the message itself, because we don't actually have the documents from all these different regions. Not for several centuries, at any rate. For the first 300 years of Christianity's existence, we have a grand total of 124 New Testament manuscripts. And every last one of them comes from Egypt. Now, admittedly, this next bit is speculation on my part, but given that the religion would change as it spread geographically, as is well documented in the Bible itself, I mean, after all, most of Paul's epistles are him fighting tooth and nail against such changes, which serves to demonstrate that those changes were in fact happening, but given that, it stands to reason that the church in Egypt would have been different from the churches in various other locations throughout the ancient world. And given that we have a well-documented manuscript tradition showing that scribes would, at least sometimes, feel free to alter the text to fit better with their theology, it's all but guaranteed that a letter being copied in Egypt would have had different changes than one copied in, say, Corinth. And if an orthodoxy emerged, where certain beliefs and practices were elevated over others, and this orthodoxy, let's hypothetically say it managed to become the official religion of the most powerful empire in the world for several centuries, and this orthodoxy has a history of going to great lengths to suppress any doctrine that they deemed to be heretical, then it's not outside the realm of plausibility that they would have destroyed any manuscripts that they deemed to be heretical, thus leaving us with just the one line of transmission from Egypt that they actually approved of. And this destruction of materials would likely be both active and passive. Actively, they'd destroy manuscripts that they thought were heretical, while passively, they'd just don't copy those manuscripts, allowing the existing ones to be lost to the sands of time. All while overwhelming the archaeological record with obsessive copying of the official Orthodox versions. Again, this is speculation on my part, we don't actually know what happened to those manuscripts, but such behavior would definitely not have been out of the ordinary for the Roman Catholic Church, and it does nicely explain why we've only ever found manuscripts from Egypt for the first 3 centuries of Christianity.
And so you almost have layers upon layers of the multifaceted aspect of the text. So it's not a single line of transmission, it's multiple lines of transmission injected with steroids.
No, it's multiple lines of transmission as filtered through a single bottleneck line of transmission in Egypt. If you play the telephone game and have multiple parallel games going at the same time, but before you get to the end, all of those parallel games have to go through one person who gets to unilaterally decide which of the parallel games they want to transmit, and may or may not transmit them faithfully, then you don't get to claim that the existence of the parallel games means that whatever came out at the end must be accurate to the originals.
When it came to scribes, they weren't asking for their qualifications, whether they had a diploma from Pharisee University. They wanted you to be able to get a copy of the text. And so this resulted in the spreading of these Christian documents really far, really quickly. And yes, that resulted in things like scribal errors and mistakes from handwriting.
Yes, and this is a problem. Because, as you said, we know that the text spread very far, very fast, but we don't have any of the far-flung texts, we only have the Egyptian ones. And as you yourself pointed out, the early scribes were not trained. Some weren't even literate and were just copying as best they could, and this resulted in many, many errors entering the text. And what's more, the time period for which we have the fewest manuscripts is also the time period when most of the scribes would have been amateurs, making mistakes and altering the text. So ultimately, we don't know what competing copies of the same text were floating around out in the world. We just know the ones that survived. And we do know that early Christianity was quite diverse in belief, mostly from the writings of proto-Orthodox church fathers who were trying to counter the claims made by the competing sects, with the books that they wrote to counter them often being our only source for their existence in the first place, as the competing Christian documents were either outright destroyed or just allowed to die a death of neglect.
But it also means that pretty early on, within a couple of centuries, you have copies of the Gospels, of Acts, of the epistles of Paul and Peter and James and Jude in places all over North Africa, throughout the Middle East, even into Asia and the British Isles.
That phrase, in a couple centuries, is doing a lot of heavy lifting, and you gotta assume that by couple he does not mean two, because it's not for at least 3 centuries. Anyway, by in a couple centuries, he seems to mean not until after the Roman Empire had officially become Christian. So yes, you find Christian documents spread throughout the Christian Empire. What else would you expect?
And so the accusation of the Da Vinci Code one, that they inserted the divinity of Christ into the Bible.
I don't know of any atheists who take the Da Vinci Code seriously. The Book of John, at the very least, is quite clear about the divinity of Jesus. Sure, there are books onto which his divinity was imposed, and even then it depends on what you mean by divinity, but with all this in mind, it's still a point of fact that it took a council organized by the Roman Emperor to decide once and for all that Jesus was, in fact, divine. I feel like that's not the kind of thing that would be necessary if he, you know, actually were.
The nature of how the text was spread out throughout the ancient world is that no one person or no one group could have controlled the text at any one point in time.
So I guess the fact that the vast, vast majority of manuscripts to ever exist were directly commissioned by the Roman Catholic Church doesn't matter? Because I'm fairly certain that they had near universal control over which books got copied and which manuscripts to copy those books from for somewhere around 1,000 years. Sure, occasionally someone would translate a Bible or a book of the Bible into a vernacular language, but the Catholic Church would actively seek out and destroy such translations in order to maintain control. If the Bible is written in a language that requires you to be highly educated in order to understand it, then that puts a barrier to the common people reading it for themselves and coming to their own conclusions. The common people must filter their understanding through their local priest, who has access to the approved official copy of the Bible from the Roman Catholic Church.
It was like shrapnel. They were blown everywhere all over the ancient world.
The officially approved versions were blown everywhere all over the ancient world. It's still more than a little suspicious that before the Roman Catholic Church became a thing, only the Egyptian manuscripts seem to have survived, despite the fact that we know that these books were circulating far and wide at that time period.
In order for Constantine to have wanted to insert anything, he would have had to go and dig up copies of, say, the Gospel of John buried in the sands of Egypt hundreds of years before he was even born.
Conversely, if he didn't want to insert things into the text but just preferred one version of Christianity over another one, all he would have had to do was declare that only the version of Christianity that he liked was the one that was allowed to persist, and then competing versions throughout the empire would either be absorbed or eliminated, and competing texts could be destroyed or ignored. I am not of the opinion that Constantine made any insertions to the text. In fact, my understanding is that Constantine, especially in his early days, was rather lackluster in his Christianity and didn't much care about the various denominational fights, calling the Council of Nicaea mainly as a way to get them to shut up about their disagreements and stop trying to get him to adjudicate them. And keep in mind, we're talking about 4th century stuff here with Constantine, meaning that the time we start to actually see ancient manuscripts coming from regions outside of Egypt corresponds with the time that one sect of Christianity became politically dominant over the other sects. So, yeah, I am not saying that Constantine dug up a bunch of manuscripts, had them edited, and then reburied them, as you seem to be implying in this argument. I'm saying that after Constantine gave one sect of Christianity political power, they used that power to suppress competing sects of Christianity. And part of that suppression probably involved the destruction of competing manuscripts.
It's not feasible and it's not probable. We know from the history of how the text spread, we know what Christians were reading in the second century and in the third and the fourth and in the fifth.
Yeah, actually, we do know a lot of what they were reading then. There was the Signs Gospel, the Gospel of Thomas, the Apocalypse of Adam, the Egerton Gospel, the Epistle of Barnabas, the Sophia of Jesus Christ, the... Oh, wait, none of those are books that made it into the Bible, are they? They are all apocryphal. And yet some of these books potentially predate the canonical Gospels. We know that there was a great diversity of Christian belief that predated the Roman Catholic Church, and we know that these competing sects died out, many of them in the wake of Christianity gaining its power in Rome. These other sects would have viewed the books that we call apocryphal as God-inspired scripture, and we know for a fact that many of them were suppressed and wiped out by the Roman Catholic Church. For some of the apocryphal books, the only knowledge we have of them comes either from Orthodox and Proto-Orthodox church leaders writing counter-apologetics against them, or from locations where the books apparently were hidden and buried for safekeeping in what appears to be an attempt to preserve them from their impending destruction. This whole argument completely ignores the fact that we know that the church actively suppressed any document that it considered to be heretical. So why would they not do the same for manuscripts of canonical gospels that had variations that they also considered heretical?
Not just in Greek and Hebrew, but in Latin, and in Coptic, and in Old Church Slavonic, and in Sahidic, Boharic, you know, you name the language. If it was in the ancient world, the Christians were trying to translate it into it.
Yes, that is correct. And fun little fact about that, the Latin text that was used by the church well into the 12th century was one called the Vestis Latina, but a guy named Jerome translated his own version of the text into Latin in the 4th century, and when the churches in North Africa heard that version read aloud, there were literal riots and protests in the churches because of how different it was from the Vestis Latina. And that version that was so different from the previous one that it literally caused riots is now known as the Latin Vulgate and has been the official Latin version of the text since the 9th century, when Charlemagne sought to standardize the texts. Yes, I am aware that I just said that the Vestis Latina was used into the 12th century, which is later than the 9th century, but it turns out standardization of texts wasn't all that easy in a time when it could take months or even years to travel across Europe, and also Charlemagne wasn't the Pope, so while he did have considerable influence over several church reforms, he was not completely successful. My point is that the official Latin Bible that is still used by the Catholic Church today was such a drastic change from the previous version that it caused riots. So to claim that changes were not being made to the text for theological or political reasons is, at best, naive. And with translated versions, it's even easier to do. It's impossible to directly translate from one language into another without there being at least some interpretation and ambiguity. Even the simplest concepts don't translate cleanly. Ask any Canadian school child for whom French is not their first language what the phrase je m'appelle means. They will likely say that it means my name is, when a direct word-for-word translation would be I am called. But because we don't introduce ourselves in English with the phrase I am called, the phrase gets mistranslated in order to better capture the actual meaning, rather than just directly translating the words. Well, what happens when there is doubt or ambiguity about the actual meaning of a phrase? In an ideal situation, whoever's doing the translating chooses the meaning that they think fits the intentions of the original author best, regardless of their personal beliefs on the matter. In reality, though, they are likely to have chosen the interpretation that fits best with their theological beliefs. Also, it is again worth mentioning that we don't actually have any of the non-Egyptian manuscripts from any of these translations from the first 300 years of Christianity's existence. So it's not like we can just use them to compare with the manuscripts that we do have to see what changes might have been made in different regions.
That history is just so vast, even under Roman persecution. The Christian message was just spread far and wide.
It bears mentioning at this point that while there were sporadic bouts of localized Christian persecution in the Roman Empire, such as Nero blaming the Christians for the fire of Rome in 64 CE, there were no empire-wide persecutions of the Christians until 303 CE, and that lasted until 311 CE, for a grand total of 8 years. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to minimize the suffering of early Christians who were persecuted, nor am I defending the act of persecution. I merely point this out because apologists like to imply, if not outright claim, that Christians suffered a systemic, empire-wide persecution for the first 300 years of their existence, which is just not the case.
And any accusation of full-scale corruption, it would have been hard to do today. It was impossible to do then.
Why? Why would it be harder to accomplish something like that back in a time when you wouldn't be called out for it immediately on social media, and where there isn't an electronic record of all the changes and revisions that you might make to a digital text? I think that sort of thing is way harder to get away with today, especially since the widespread adoption of the internet, than it would have been back then. And even then, they didn't completely get away with it. They got away with it enough to maintain and expand their political power and influence, but looking back on it now, we know that there were all sorts of shenanigans going on and that the Catholic Church was undeniably a corrupt organization that was bent on gaining and keeping as much power and control as they could. Why would you expect that the destruction of heretical documents would be off the table when we know for a fact that they engaged in the destruction of heretical documents? That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from JimmyJames8164, who says, Amalek and his tribe were Nephilim, but I assume you don't know what that is either. If Nephilim were still here today, no human would survive. Study for yourself, or remain ignorant and continue to look like a fool. Yeah, you know what, I've seen this claim before, and there's a few problems with it. First, there is zero evidence to support the idea that there were a race of giants living back then, with the only evidence being mediocre Photoshop jobs found in YouTube videos. Second, I have never found an adequate justification for believing that the authors of the Bible thought that the Amalekites were Nephilim. They are mentioned alongside each other once in Numbers 13, where the Hebrew spies give the report of who lived in the Promised Land, but they never called the Amalekites Nephilim. They are just both groups of people who live in the land that they're about to conquer. Third, Genesis 6 speaks rather positively about the Nephilim, saying the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. Mighty men of renown doesn't sound like a bad thing, and this makes it seem like they were a type of people who had died out before the flood. Fourth, the Genesis 6 mention, even if we ignore the implied dying out of these great men of renown, comes before the flood, so if the Nephilim were real, which to be clear they were not, they would have died out in the flood. The fact that the Bible mentions them still existing after the flood is a bit of a problem for people who want to believe that the flood was a literal global flood that killed everything on the planet except what was on Noah's Ark. I mean, the olive tree surviving the flood kinda obviously quashes that view, but young Earth creationists don't seem to have a problem with that one for some reason, so why not the Nephilim too? Sure, it works. I mean, it doesn't, but we'll go with it. Fifth, if the ancient Hebrews were able to wipe out the Nephilim, then why do you think that the Nephilim would have successfully wiped out all of humanity? If a tribe with Bronze Age weapons could do it, why would future generations with better weapons have a problem? Sixth, the Amalekites were not, in fact, wiped out. At least not if we believe the Bible. Because King David had issues with them after he took over from Saul, despite Saul apparently wiping them all out except for one dude. That dude must have gotten around quite a bit to build them back up into a nation that was a legitimate threat to King David in just a couple years. So, if I grant your point, humanity should no longer exist, as the Amalekites were never completely wiped out. Given that humanity continues to exist, I am of the opinion that you are wrong. So, Jimmy, feel free to study for yourself, or remain ignorant and continue to look like a fool. Thanks for watching. Don't forget to head to merch.vicerhino.com and use code RHINO15 for 15% off your order. I'll be back next Friday with more, but if you need to get your rhino fix in before then, I live stream with Cirrus every Wednesday at 8:30 Eastern on my other channel, The Watering Hole, and I stream with my partner every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern here. Thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon and sponsorships manager, and special thanks as always to my patrons, Scott Boringer, Alone on Mars, and all the rest, who are the well-documented history that my channel has of eliminating those who disagree with me. If you'd like to prove that I'm right because I'm the only transmission line from the telephone game, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my P.O. Box address is in the description. See you next time!